I can't read the Hebrew, but I'm hoping you can help us with that. Not yet. I like your optimism. I appreciate that. Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Or is it the heavens and the earth? Or is it when God began to create heaven and earth? We're going to try to make sense of this all as we take a closer look at the creation story in Genesis. But first, let me explain how I came to the idea for this episode. In 1967, a medieval historian by the name of Lynn White published an article called The Historical Roots of Our Ecological Crisis. In this article, White argued that the ecological threats facing the planet, he was already thinking about climate change, as well as pollution, nuclear holocaust, all the fun stuff, could be traced back to what he calls the marriage between science and technology that really took off in the mid-19th century in Europe. He also argues that this turning point in human history was predicated on a Judeo-Christian worldview. In other words, he kind of blames the creation story in Genesis. Unlike in Greek and Roman mythology, where White says time is fundamentally cyclical and thus the idea of a beginning was impossible, Christianity inherits from Judaism a concept of time as non-repetitive and linear. White also underscores something you may remember from the Genesis story, the idea that man is given dominion over plants and animals. As he puts it, no item in the physical creation had any purpose save to serve man's purposes. Since the publication of this article, White's theory has been hotly debated. I wanted to take a closer look. What really happens in this creation story, and what are we to make of it? I knew the thing to do was to ask a rabbi. And as luck or fate or mazel would have it, I found just the right person. So I read up on you a little bit. You sound like an interesting guy, I have to say.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I wonder what you find. Yeah, tell me what you find.
Sounds like this is Rabbi Isaiah Rothstein I'm talking to. He is indeed an interesting guy. He grew up in an interracial family in Muncie, New York.
And it's like one of the largest Orthodox Jewish populations in the world, probably in like the top 10, 5 Jewish communities. And so I was raised mixed race. My mom's an African-American convert. And so like my whole life growing up in the Orthodox community and the ultra-Orthodox community, I had like side locks as a kid. Like I would also go to like Chicago and California where I would visit my mom's like Methodist family who also converted to like Islam, some of them, and became Buddhists or became just, you know, citizens of the world. But we were always like kind of a cultured family. You know, our family, we could trace our family from my mom's side to the Revolutionary War. There's the Nicholas Gibbs Historical Society. That's my ancestor. He's one of the founding members of Rhode Island, I believe. And so like that thread, and my great-grandfather was a minister in Morgantown, West Virginia, like very WASPy. Like that's like one side. And then my grandfather married my grandmother and they were an interracial couple in the 40s, which was like kind of unheard of. So that was my mom's mom on the revolutionary side. And my mom's father comes from the slave narrative where he was a slave in America. So like as a little kid, knowing all of that and going to visit my family, but also while also being in New York and in Muncie and growing up in the Haredi, the ultra-Orthodox community, like I had a lot to play with and a lot to like consider, a lot to think about.
When Isaiah Rothstein was in college, he started to staff Birthright trips.
Birthright's like around a 20-year-old organization that was started by like really wealthy philanthropists who basically were saying like less than, you know, 20% of American Jewry reads the Torah, the Bible on a weekly basis. And Jewish engagement is at an all-time low. People don't feel connected to the faith. So like, let's bring them to Israel. Like let's bring, it's their birthright. Like it's their birthright. So like this organization was sending people 18 to 25 to Israel for a 10-day free trip. And because I came from a background of like literacy and I had been to Israel, I studied there for a year and a half, like I would go as a staff. And I staffed like 7 or 8 of those trips. Also as a musician, I would like bring my music and
Oh yeah, did I mention he's a rapper and a musician? That's from a song of his called The Goodness. We'll play the full version at the end of the episode. But getting back to our introduction, Isaiah Rothstein staffed 7 of those 10-day trips to Israel while he was in college. He'd been studying business and music, but essentially found himself performing the role of a rabbi at a very young age.
Unintentionally, I was like really kind of giving pastoral spiritual care through these trips. And like I had bar and bat mitzvah, like brought people to this moment, probably like 50 people. I probably gave out like 30 plus names, and I was like 20, 21, wow. 22. So by the time I finished college, I decided I wanted to be a rabbi, basically.
Yeah. Since becoming a rabbi, Isaiah Rothstein has fostered diversity and inclusiveness in Jewish community. He was one of the founding members of Base Community in Washington Heights and the Union Street Sanctuary, places that are designed to appeal to a younger generation, and he's expanded his work to encompass the movement of Jewish environmentalism in his work with Chazon.
Chazon is the Jewish Lab for Sustainability, not the first, but the largest of the Jewish environmental organizations. And what introduced me to the organization is our home, our retreat center, which is Isabella Friedman Jewish Retreat Center. It's in the Berkshires. They have around 7,500, 8,000 people come up throughout the year, hundreds of organizations that use our space. So it's kind of become its own ecosystem. It has a farm program. It has a eco-Torah, Jewish outdoor food farming, environmental education platform. We have experts in all the different fields, anything from, like you were saying, native plants to trees to the water system. And we have 400 acres of trail. So like I went up there and I was like, whoa, you know. And then I met the CEO at one point, and it was a good match in the sense that, you know, being mixed race and passing for white, my relationship in the mainstream homogenous Jewish spaces would be like, I would be undercover. Like people would say certain things. So as I got older, like how that, like the way I was impacted by that as a youth, like it got into my bones in a way. So then when I got older, I started doing more social equity justice work as well. And like really trying to unpack whiteness, unpack race in the Jewish community. So pertinent issues, like already, like being able to facilitate dialogue around sensitive issues was like something that I was like already doing. And I think when it comes to the climate crisis, which, you know, Chazon's, one of our many lines that we say is that we are in a global environmental crisis and the Jewish tradition compels us to respond. And we also believe to live sustainably is a Jewish value, to like think about how we waste and what, there are laws of how we treat our animals, industrial meat, all the things, like, and we can, you know, this idea of kosher, like what does kosher mean? Like just because something has a symbol in it doesn't mean it's kosher. If kosher means it's fit to eat, then sometimes maybe how our meat is being even processed might not be making it kosher then, fit to eat. So, you know, we have 20,000 people in our network and we're in 5 different offices around the country. And specifically now, I think with the climate strike, that just took place 2 weeks ago, which we were very, very involved in. We co-founded the Jewish Climate Coalition, which now has 36 organizations from the Jewish community that we're trying to make a national platform. And so, like, I think Chazon's work, just like how you might be able to say that, like, the slave narratives of the Bible were, like, waiting for those few enslaved cultures and people throughout history, namely Africans, right? Like that they were able to draw so much from the history of the Jewish slavery in Egypt 3,500 years ago, that it was waiting. It was almost as if like who was waiting for who? Was like the Exodus narrative waiting for slavery, or was slavery waiting for the, and like, I think the same thing is true for the climate crisis in a way that like there's so much there. And it's been waiting. The Torah has been waiting for us to access it in a way.
That's such an interesting claim. I also read on with the new year, I read on the Chazon site that the year 5780 is the year of the environmental teshuva.
Yeah.
So can you explain what that means and what
totally.
That's about?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. Yes, chazon.org/environmental teshuva. So first, I guess I'll define the word teshuva. You know, it's interesting. You'll if you hear as I intonate, you'll hear teshuva, which has like similar letters of Shabbat, the Sabbath. So Shabbat means like to sit or to rest, but it also has this idea of like returning to your authentic self. Each week we are being pulled apart by 6 days of working, and for one day we just like return to this like core self. And so tshuva has this word of shuv, like to return. And it's like a this idea that like we are created with this pure spirit, a part of us, but throughout life we make mistakes and we cover ourselves up, or we lose center, or we go off path. And so this idea of tshuva is like, you know, the rabbis argued like 1,000 years ago of whether it's like a formal mitzvah. Like, is there a mitzvah to like do tshuva, or is it like what the rabbis call a mitzvah klalit, like a mitzvah that you're supposed to do throughout everything that you do? So it's not like a mitzvah, because it's like, what do you mean? Like a part of being a person is trying to work on yourself to grow. So another like idea on tshuva, the rabbis write in the Talmud, you know, around 1600 years ago, they wrote this phrase that said like 7 things were created before the creation of the world. You know, one of them is like Eden, Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden was created somehow, like the thought of it. Another is the Torah, right? The Bible itself was created before somehow. Again, these mystical meta ideas that we could unpack another time. And another one of those 7 creations is teshuvah. From that, like rabbinic teaching for me, like what I gather from that is that ultimately, if those things were prerequisites for the creation of the world, it's almost saying that like a part of being in this natural world is that these things are in the fabric of what it means to be in the world. And so this idea of teshuva, like this idea of wanting to be better, like that, like we try to give people the benefit of the doubt that people just, that naturally, like trees just want to go up. Like they just want to go up. Like, right? And so like humans also, like we just want, I mean, again, there might be a question of like, what about real true evil that exists in the world? And what about that? But like this idea that it was teshuva was a prerequisite for creation. So with all of that, I think connecting the word environmental teshuva to it is, you know, Chazon, we put a billboard in Times Square like 1.5 months ago declaring 5780 this year, this Jewish calendar year, as the year of environmental teshuva, where, you know, so much of the Jewish calendar cycle, like, you know, there's different holidays. I sometimes call it like seasonal Judaism, where like people tap into like matzah in April and people tap into light on Hanukkah in December. And like, but really, like, shouldn't I be thinking about matzah in a way all year round? Like, maybe not like the same. Maybe I don't need to eat that every Shabbat instead of challah, but like, you know, to be having it in frame of thinking. So teshuva, again, if it's like a mitzvah klali, if it's something I'm supposed to do every day, it's not about like a season. But we also know that Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, it's like a time of deep introspection and reflection and thinking about the choices that we make on a regular basis and thinking about our relationships and thinking about the people we surround ourselves with and thinking about the choices we make and the impact that they have 2 or 3 degrees away from even what I do, like meaning where my garbage goes, as an example. So environmental teshuva for us is like, we need to raise our game as like a faith group, and we need to raise our game, especially now when like there's no, the science isn't that great. I mean, it's great on like the numbers of how much percentage is for it, but it's not that great. We are in a global environmental crisis that was caused by humans, like whatever, wherever you want to put it, like period, like, you know. So, you know, my boss / CEO / mentor, Nigel Savage, who coined the phrase environmental teshuva. And during the climate strike, we had signs, you know, on the front of them was like different quotes and like kind of BuzzFeed-y Jewish lines, like keeping climate contracts since Noah, or like Jewish mother's guilt has nothing on the planets, or something. Like, and but on the back of all of them had this phrase, # environmental teshuva.
Now that you've gotten to know Rabbi Isaiah Rothstein a bit, let's get to our reading of Genesis.
If it's okay with you, I would like to start with the very beginning and go through it. I have, and sadly, I can't read the Hebrew, but I'm hoping you can help us with that. Not yet. I like your optimism. I appreciate that. So can you maybe, can you read the Hebrew of just chapter 1, verse 1?
Sure.
And tell us how you think it might be translated in English?
Great. Yeah, totally. And as I begin, you know, I, as an American, though I know the Hebrew and I've learned the Hebrew, sometimes those translations can't help but creep into our thinking. So I'm going to do my best to actually just translate it for what it looks like on the page in the Hebrew only. So the first line says, Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz. Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz. Bereshit, the bet, the be, being the first Hebrew letter of the word Bereshit, is also the second letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and it means in this context. Bereshit, in the first moment, in the first Bereshit. And the rabbis have lots of commentaries on this word, like tons of commentaries just on the first word, like where all the other references to the word Reshit of the firsts, like what does it mean first? Then does Bereshit, what is Bara Shis, like this in Aramaic sheet, not like the curse word, but in Hebrew Shis is six. So like there were six, what, like all these Bishvil Reshit, the rabbis say it's conjugated word to like, it's for the sake of the beginning. So Bereshit in the first, right? In this first what? Bara Elohim, right? This name Elohim or Elohim, also how Islam, Allah, same root, really means power or powers. And, you know, there's in the Jewish faith, there are 70 names of God, and each one is more of a intimate relationship to God. One is a little bit more distant, reverent. Elohim is like a force, is a power, is a, right, when may the force be with you, it's Elohim, you know?
It's excellent.
So at the, you know, in the first moment when Elohim created, et, the, and the rabbis even play with that because the word et is like, you know, I don't know the exact, like, grammar term for that. But it is, you know, a connecting word to a statement. And so, but also the word et has the first letter of the alphabet and the second letter and the last letter of the alphabet, the aleph and the tuf. So some of the Hasidic, more meta philosophical rabbis say we should just stop the line there. And it should read, Bereshit bara Elokim et. In the beginning, God created letters and everything is made out of the letters. So like, you know, there's like a story of one of the Hasidic rabbis from the 17th century who, like, on his deathbed, he, instead of calling things what they were, he would spell them out. And so maybe there would be, like, some actual, you know, medical reasons why someone might do that. But the way the lesson or the essence of the story was saying that, like, he was able to see the world through the lens of what they were truly meant to be, which is not just the definitions of what we, like, not just what we think the definition of something is, or, so a table is a table, but is it really a table? Like, we call it table, but, like, no, it's a shulchan, and that has a whole, you know, in Hebrew, and the word shulchan has this idea of shaleach, to be sent, that you send something, you put something here, and through it, something else emerges, like, there's a, you know, so he was able to spell out, and then not, more than that, like, the shin, that letter has a whole meaning to it. It has three heads on it, and it's shit. So, like, there's all this mystical things that I think.
So basically, literary critics have nothing on the rabbis. I mean, I already knew this, but.
But so the Kabbalah plays a deep role in, like, a lot of what we're, you know.
Yeah.
And also, if you look at commentaries on the first book of the Torah versus the third book of the Torah, let's say, there's way more for the first book because there's so, right. There's so much more going on to, I think, to unpack.
Yeah.
And then the last words of this line has Shemayim ve'et ha'aretz. So Shemayim, meaning you could say heaven, or because there's another word, Rakia, which might actually mean more like the dark matter of space versus Shemayim, which is the clouds more, because the word Shemayim is also one of the rabbis say is like a conjugated word of Shem. Mayim, there, that there is water, Shemayim, there's water. And so that might more mean our atmosphere might be the Shemayim, because we know that the atmosphere is what contains all of, you know, the cycle of rains. So Shemayim, and Et Ha'aretz, right, being the earth or the physical realm. And so this is where, like, you know, ultimately there's a thousand questions that could emerge. Is like, is this talking about day one? What is this talking about? Is this talking about the creation of our solar system? Is this talking about the Big Bang? Is this talking about what, like, what's going on? Like, and that, I think, you know, there are rabbis who, more of recent years, but even 12th century already, rabbis, doctors, physicians, physicists, like, they were all already asking these questions. But even more recently, people have, you know, compared NASA's notes to medieval commentators and seeing where they overlap and where they don't, making sense of.
So I have a million questions, but let's start with time, because I feel like that's one of the questions that gets posed. So do you feel like there's a concept of time at play here? Is it linear time? Is it a kind of in medias res? Like, do you have a feeling?
I actually wrote down that you said that from quoting that that teacher.
Yeah.
Right. So he said that time is non-repetitive.
So it's Lynn White. His name. Yeah. The article was called "The Historical Roots of our Ecologic Crisis." So right, he talks about linear time, and I've read different commentaries. Like one, well, this is sort of tangential, but one thing that the Oxford Annotated Edition talks about the idea that this is not a creation from nothing. And I feel like there's something implied about time in that. But what was that you said? You didn't use the word beginning. You used the word start. Was that what you were? First. Yeah.
So.
So that's different.
Yeah. Bereshit in the beginning. In the beginning of what?
Yeah.
I don't think any, you know, just again, like if we were coming with young eyes, like we've never ever heard the first line of the Bible in our lives, right?
Yeah, yeah.
In the beginning of what? Like, I mean, I read the story. I went to school. You know, so I'm like, oh, beginning of the, you know, depending on who you're asking. Like, you know, if you're asking a 5-year-old, they may give you a different answer or a more sophisticated answer than anyway. So yeah, in terms of time, though, just to go where you just asked, metrics of time. So like, one thing I'll say is, like, yes, very often people call Jews the people of the book, but I would also say we're very much people of time, to the point where, like, today is Shabbat, is Saturday, the day of rest according to the Jewish tradition, and we believe that the right time to light those candles is literally 6:04 today. And if you do it late or if you do it early, it's not the same thing. And so there's sensitivity to time already. I think it's very strong. But then when it comes to, like, metrics of time and how time is calculated, we know that if you just read by reading a little further, that the metrics of time that we use, being the sun and the moon as the primary metrics of time, were only created on the fourth day. So everything before the fourth day cannot be calculated based on how we've used the luminaries in the sky, the sun and the moon, as our metrics. So I think that, to me, like, when I was able to understand that, it opened up all the science, like the 4.5 billion years for me.
I see.
It shifted my whole consciousness around how do we resolve that conflict, because ultimately, like, wait, like, if we're saying that based on the sun and the moon that the universe has been around for 4.5 billion years, I don't think that's in conflict with the Torah. Like, who knows how long the first day was or the second day was or the third day was, like. Right. And, you know, the order, we know that the order of how things did come into matter and being kind of does align also with the Torah, like, starting anyway.
One of my questions was going to be, is there a beginning? If there's a beginning, is there an end? But if you're saying one possible translation is first, then we're in a whole different ballgame, right? Mm. Then it could be infinite, potentially. So,
or there were other firsts.
Too. Or there, yeah. We're like this multiverse.
This is the first of this one. There's another commentary from the rabbis that say there was like 900 generations before the creation of the world, where the angels were just the kind of the lower beings, and you know, also saying that the world was destroyed several times, and, like, you know, where beings like Lilith, like different characters are actually coming from previous peoples or people, or different species. Like, you know, there's all these, I mean, there's a lot out there of for where to sit with them.
So a totally separate podcast that I want to do at one point is going to be on the apocalypse. Because, and the idea for the germination for that was how many representations of the apocalypse are you see in popular culture nowadays. And, you know, you can't help but think that, like, is this a way of expressing our anxiety about what's going on in the world, you know? But when you start to delve into that, then you start to look at conceptions of time, too. And, you know, one of White's argument is that, and he's talking more about Christianity than Judaism, but that when you go from a pagan model to a Christian model, one of the things that happens is that you go from cyclical time, so the seasons and the idea of renewal, and you could attach sustainability to that, to linear time.
Right.
And of course, what you think is going to happen at the end is one of the things that determines how you feel about the world. You know,
It changes everything.
Yeah.
It changes everything. I mean, you know, when I teach kids who are often resistant to, like, Torah, at least how it's framed through traditional, like, pedagogy and stuff, I'll say, like, listen, at the end of the day, it boils down to two choices. Either you're here, I'm like, yeah, you're just here, and, like, guess what? You're going to die, and you're going to become bugs, and worms are going to eat you, and that's it. And so you might as well just party really hard while you're here, right? Just do everything you can, like kind of what Ecclesiastes, Kohelet, King Solomon writes about. Or, like, no, like, you're literally breathing your ancestors' breath, and you are literally, like, a part of a legacy, and you are, like, that there's a higher purpose to all of this, and that the choices you make impact generations, and, like, and that you are Adam and Eve, basically, of your generation at any, and, like, you just need to make a choice. Like, yeah, and, like, Greek mythic versus, you know, Eastern kind of traditions will push in different directions, right? Like, the ancient Persian Zoroastrianism, like, or versus, like, Greek ethics, and or where Judaism kind of sat in the middle of all of that. Yeah, it's like an interesting challenge. But what I would say, the way, you know, at least like theologically and philosophically speaking, the way the Jewish tradition looks at time is both as a cycle, but also really a spiral. And by spiral, what that means is that no one moment is at the same level. Like, they're different experiences. But let's say Passover, that falls out on April 14th, let's say, this year, right? And when one sits at the Passover Seder, they're literally tapping into the first Passover. Mm-hmm. And as much as it's not the same thing, it's a spiral. So it's like, okay, I'm in the 2019 Passover and not in, you know, 1400 BCE Passover, but, like, they're literally aligned in the spiral of time. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of what I think also creates a lot of Jewish neuroses around, like, holidays and stuff, because everyone's so, like, edgy. Everybody, like, it's like Rosh Hashanah. It's not just, like, September 29th Rosh Hashanah. It's literally, like, God commanded us literally this day, and so we're doing it because it connects to that first moment, and it'll connect to the every other Rosh Hashanah after this moment. There's something about that.
High stakes.
Mm-hmm. And then, like, beginning and ends. I don't, you know, the concept of the Mashiach and Messiah in Jewish tradition doesn't really say that the world will look that different, other than there'll be better levels of accessibility for everyone to live a life that they want to live. God's name will be known throughout the whole world. So pretty much everyone will become a monotheist, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. And then how the Messiah gets there is contested from different kind of sides of the aisle of Jewish history. So in that way, time, even at the Messiah, doesn't stop. It actually, it's, if anything, it's like the beginning of another era. Like, it's not the end of, it's a closing of something, but it's not the end of anything. It's just a transition into, like, a higher sense of purpose for the whole world.
I feel like often when you think A or B, it's inevitably C, right?
Right. Or it's both, or it's gray, or right. It's right. Yeah. Or it's just yes. Is it A or B? Yes.
Right. Right. So, sticking with verse 1, so Aretz, is that how you pronounce the word for that gets translated as earth?
Yes, Aretz.
So or I understand Eretz. That there are two words that get translated as earth in the creation story of Genesis. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, there's Eretz or Aretz, And there's Adama, which is more like talking about soil. There's also the word afar, which is like dust particles of soil. It's like another name. You know, so like when it talks about the creation of Adam and Eve, it says like, Vayitzer Hashem Elokim ha'adam min ha'afar, Vayipach ha'adam. So Adam, Adama is already talking about like clay, earth, soil. And then it says Vayipach ba'pav nishma rucha. And then it, like, then God breathed the breath of life into Adam. And like, so yeah. And then also when it comes to the just, you know, the destruction of the world from in Noah and the flood, it uses language also of like Aretz and Adama. So yes, there are those varying languages, but Aretz is actually referring to just, I think, really matter, like the physical world, everything growing from
it. So not, you know, I mean, of course we're thinking in modern terms as the globe, which is, you know, not really appropriate to the cosmology.
I think like the, if we're thinking of like land and water, anything that is like earth that we can stand on is called Eretz. Cause it also, you know, another phrase from the Torah that, you know, I think in Deuteronomy is like, God says, Ki li kol ha'aretz, which is like for, you know, the kol ha'aretz, all the lands are mine. Like, so it's like almost talking about like earth, like.
I like this image of something you can stand on because I think we're trained to think in scientific terms, sort of objectively. So like Earth, a picture pops up in my head, you know, of the globe or something like that. But of course, you know, even today, in spite of our technology, we don't know anything in a way that is not through our own experience, right? So really what Earth is to us is, in a sense, the experience of Earth. Do you see what
I'm
saying?
Yeah, yeah. And which is crazy because like, what's it called? Pangea? What was it? What was the name of?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So like, just to think about the fact that the earth is moving and changing and like, you know, places in the world, like rising seawater, like the name, the definition of Aretz is fluid, right? It can change. And it has changed. You know?
I feel like that opening of Genesis really captures what we now think of as that fluidity, though, right? One of the striking things is a lot of the creation happens through separation. It's not a creation out of nothing.
Right.
It's the distinguishing of things, which I think is really... For those of you who aren't familiar with the text or haven't read Genesis in a while, I'm referring to the divisions. For example, in chapter 1, verse 1, God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. I'm quoting from a modern Jewish translation here. A similar division happens between the dry land and the seas, between evening and morning, and so on.
You know, the Kabbalists call God Ein Sof, or Ein Sof, a light that never ends, right? And it's basically referring to the Big Bang. It's saying that this thing that, okay, maybe it was like, you know, again, is it something from nothing? Like, yeah, that's radical, but yes, it is that, like, in a way. And, but it's saying that, like, right, we've only explored what? I think we've seen something like 5% of the universe or something. Like, we're aware that there's like 95% that we just will never touch because it's just hundreds of millions of light years away, and like our technology just can't. But it's Ein Sof. It's just it continues. And so like specifically to how we like kind of define the world, earth, creation, like we're saying that God is in all of these things, I would say. And it's like all emanating from that one force and source. It's so it's like it is something from nothing, but it's also that it has its own creative process to it, I think.
So this is more Christian terminology, forgive me, but
no,
I feel like in Christian terminology, one talks about God as being both transcendent and omnipresent. What, I mean, I'm sure there's not one view, but what would a Jewish view be in that sense? Because I feel like that's an important question in creation, right? Is God a part of nature, or does God stand apart in some sense and, you know, usher out what we think of as creation?
Yeah, I love that question. I think that there's a few ways to answer that. I think that both are realities in the sense that if we think of like our psychosocial development and like what, at what ages do we understand more complex things, right? So like if you look at the Torah that way, you'll see more juvenile understandings of God through the narratives, like where like there's conflict, right? There's complaining, like there's a, you know, there's a storyline that in the midst of the splitting sea, Jews started complaining, not believing that God would actually be there for them, like in the midst of like huge walls of water, like they were still, so like there's just different, I think that there's just different relationships that we can have with our creator. And then specifically to like, what's the view, you know, if you look at Maimonides, who's like game changer for Judaism, you know, he, rabbi, doctor, astronomer, all the things, he says that like everything that the Torah says about God's for emotions are there for us as humans to understand God, because we need the anthropomorphic languages for us to like understand God, but be not mistaken that God has no form. And like once we like when it says that God took us out with a strong hand, right? Or it says that like God gets angry, right? What do those things really mean? It's like an complex thing, but the Maimonides says it's like there for us to connect with God because God gave us that so we could connect to God. This idea, because otherwise it's like just too beyond. But what we also, you know, one of the central tenets of Judaism is that God has no form and that God is one. So if God is one, now that's like a whole other trip, right? Because if God is one, that means that the microphone I'm using right now is a part of God. If we're being really radical, right, that this table, and the rabbis kind of write that there is an angel that God sends as a messenger to stand over every blade of grass telling it to grow. That somehow, like, God is literally infused in every single thing. And so, like, when we say, like, you know, one of the prayers that Jews will say in the morning when they wake up is, like, Elokai neshama shenatatabi tohorahi, this breath that you placed in me is pure. And, like, I could be the biggest sinner in the world, but that won't change because it's a part of God. So, like, you know, and even, like, what kind of sins you could do that could cast you off forever is, like, so hard in Judaism because you're, like, a part of, even your bad has, like, these are radical ideas, but even your bad has God in it. So with that outlook, I think, you know, is Judaism monotheistic or, like, pantheistic? Like, it might be, you know, if pantheism is God is everything, because that's, right, like, literally everything, right? And nothing, because there's no term, it's beyond our psychology. We need to put characteristics to God because it's so beyond us. Like, it's like, I don't even know what to call it, right? Like, it, him, he, she, they, you know, but, like, we need that. Like, we, otherwise, you know, I think there's, like, the classic philosophy joke slash not so funny, but, like, is, like, you know, the professor gives a test and the final exam and puts, like, a chair on front table and says, prove to me that this chair doesn't exist. And so everyone starts right where, like, everyone's intense, like, with all their things that they learned about the theories of this and that, and, like, all the philosophers that they need to quote, Levinas, all, whatever, symbolism, whatever. And this one guy is just, like, not writing anything. And, like, professor says, all right, 30 seconds. And he's, like, sees this one guy, or gal, or person, whatever, not filling it out. And then at the end, he just writes, like, jots down two lines, two words. He hands up the exam, and what was written in the exam was, what chair? Right? And that was it. And so, like, God, like, is God, who decides, like, right? Yes, God shows up in God's kind of ways, but, like, who decides how to react to them? Like, we do. Like, we're the ones who are, like, that's maybe the idea of, like, we're created in the image of God. Like, we are God. And not in the scary power, like, we could control the universe kind of way, but in the sense that we have been built with this ability to see the world in a way that no other species can. And, like, we are co-creators. Like, we create. Like, we are, I guess, beavers make dams and, you know, and all the different, but we have been given the power to really go to the moon and soon Mars, I think, in a few years.
Okay, so I'm going to channel this guy, Lynn White, for a second. So if that's true, I mean, is there a risk of sort of anthropomorphism there, where we humans kind of set ourselves apart from other animals because we name the animals, because we... Well, maybe we should go to this.
Let's go to
the dominion part, or that's probably a problematic translation, but...
It is. And I sent you that commentary and what the commentator says, right?
And actually, the translation that I was mainly using uses rule, I think. So in chapter 1, 24 through 28, God creates every kind of living creature, and God said, you can... tell me later that this is that I'm
No, please.
let us make man in our image, is that right? Correct. After our likeness, they shall rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, the cattle, the whole of the earth, and all the creeping things that creep on the earth. And then there's the part where God created man in his image. In the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. God blessed them, and God said to them, be fertile and increase, fill the earth and master it, and rule the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, and all the living things that creep on the earth.
Mm-hmm.
So one could read that as we're in charge. And does that give us too much power? Does that belittle in some way other creatures, other non-human creatures?
Yeah, I love this. I think it is like kind of, if we look at the text at face value with certain translations, it's true, it seems like it's like, diminutive, where we are in control, you know. But when looking at the oral tradition from Judaism of what these verses were really saying, you know, there's another line that's a little later, I believe, that says "Vayave Elodam Lirot Ma Yikrelo," that God took Adam, Ha'adam, Adam and Eve, throughout the garden, showing them all the animals, and he said, "Vayave Elodam Lirot Ma Yikrelo," like, look at them and see their qualities and what they are, and then figure out what to name them, right? That, like, yes, to be their master, so to speak, but also, like, to look at them, understand them. And so there's all these commentaries on, like, the wisdom of Adam and Eve to know, to look at an animal and to say, like, oh, like, this is your strength, like, this is your quality, like, this is what you're unique for. Like, an example is, like, a dog. Dog in Torah is kelev. The word lev means heart. Ke means like. So kelev is like a heart, like, just so sweet, you want to so pleasing, you know. So it's like each, you know, and King Solomon spoke to animals, and there's the Shir HaShirim, these like songs of songs that like are supposed to tap into mystical deep qualities of animals, of nature. So anyway, the point being that I think that as much as it's showing that we are masters of the physical world and universe. And I know another text that I sent to you was this, one of the often quoted Jewish environmental texts. It's a midrash from like the 7th or 8th century that talks about how like God took Adam and Eve throughout the whole planet, took them from one corner of the earth to the other corner of the earth and back. They say that Adam and Eve's eyes is that they could actually see just like, you know, from like, let's say Ethiopia all the way to New York, like they could see just like, and said, be sure not to destroy this planet because no one else will come back to repair it after you, right? Mm-hmm. And like, there's no planet B, as they say, right? So like, so there's a relationship that's supposed to be carved between animals and humans. And yes, like in that relationship from the Torah's perspective, we are set up to be the stewards of all living things. Mm-hmm. Like, and what the commentator Rashi says, French rabbi, from the 12th century, he writes that, like, yeah, irdu, like this idea of to dominate, also has the same letters as to be lowered, right? So, like, if you continued, this is my commentary, but if you are going to set up a multi-billion-dollar meat industry and dairy industry in industrial ways, then, like, you are literally more barbaric than animals are. You've lowered yourself. You've flipped on its head what the whole purpose was to begin with. Like, mm-hmm. I want you to steward, right? And the next line, by the way, like two lines after, it says you could eat. But it doesn't say you should eat animals. It says you should eat all the plants, mm-hmm. right? We know that, like, the permissibility around eating meat comes later. And even later, it's like, takes a few, over 1,000 years before it's like, you know, fully permissible. Like, the rabbis, like, struggle with, like, are you allowed to? Who, when, how? Mm-hmm. Sacred meat versus like all that kind of stuff. So I think it's like a misread almost to like view it as we are, listen, I know that like there are a lot of folks who like, with God bless them, that like focus so much on like protecting animal species and saying that we have no right to be, we should be equal to animals. I don't really agree with that personally. Like I don't, that's not my philosophy on that. Like I don't think that like dolphins are equal to us, and I don't think that they should be treated equal to us. But I do think that like they have been given the responsibility to like l'avodah l'shamra, to work the earth and to protect it or to steward it. Like dolphins were not given that role. Like they have a, they have their own role, and like they might be one of the smartest animals on the planet, but that's not their role. Our role is to steward. That's our role. Like,
well, I mean, I think regardless of what you think, you know, the ideal circumstances would be, clearly it's up to us at this point, right? We are in this position for better, for worse. I want to go back to the naming for a second. It reminds me of, there's an author I really like, Native American botanist named Robin Wall Kimmerer, and she talks about a Native American legend where naming is very important. And it sort of, she sort of brings out the way in that there's sort of an intimacy, a relationship that is at work, you know, in that business of naming.
Yeah, they're this idea of wisdom, the Hebrew word for wisdom is chachma. Chachma means wisdom. A chacham is a wise person. And one of the Hasidic philosophers, he takes the word chachma and he flips the letters around and jumbles them. And it actually spells out koachma, which is like, what is the its strength? To have chachma, to have wisdom, is to know what something is like. What is the unique character of something? And so, God endowed Adam and Eve with this unique quality of wisdom.
Rabbi Rothstein and I ran out of time at the end of our interview, and we agreed that we'd like to continue talking. Perhaps next time we can talk about the Garden of Eden. You might have noticed that when I asked Rabbi Rothstein a question, the answer often didn't go in the direction I was expecting. A question often opened up new questions, but also new possibilities. Take the example of time. We started with a contrast between cyclical time and linear time, and we ended up with a spiral. But actually, what stuck with me more is the idea of the Jewish people as the people of time, and that it makes a difference if you light the Shabbat candles at 6:05 instead of 6:04. To me, that opens up a whole new dimension of time. And it's not one of punctuality per se, but rather of the moment, of presence in the moment. At least, I think that's what it is. I hesitate to define it because really it's a feeling of time that I came away with. I don't think we solved the problem that Lynn White sets out. Is it true that we've inherited from Genesis a notion that it's our right to control and manipulate nature? Rabbi Rothstein would lead us to believe that if this is a legacy of Judeo-Christian thought, it's based on a reductive reading of Genesis, that we need to look closer and re-examine it. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For episode notes and links to other material, go to my website, in-the-weeds.net. I'm now on Twitter at InTheWeedsPod. I've also got the link on the website. Follow me and send me links to things I should know. Coming up, I've got an interview with Dan Flores about his book Coyote America, and one with Christiana Zenner on the Pope's encyclical on the environment, and lots of other cool stuff. See you soon. Stand and say
Zion Ta'ir Veneskach Olanu Meira Leoro Or Chadash Zion Ta'ir Veneskach Olanu Meira Betuva b'chol yom tamid ha mechadesh betuva.